You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for joining us for this really important discussion about Kyrgyzstan, which has been in the news all summer and through today. My name is Rachel Denver. I'm the acting director of the Europe and Central Asia Division of Human Rights Watch. I'm very, very pleased to introduce staff from the International Center for the for Transitional Justice. First and foremost, the vice president of for programs of the International Center for Transitional Justice, Hani Magali, who is also my former colleague at Human Rights Watch. And Hani will be speaking first, followed by Marcy Mirsky, to my right, who has held various leadership positions in truth, in several truth-seeking commissions and justice reform efforts with a number of institutions, most recently with the United Nations Commission of Inquiry into the assassination of Benazir Bhutto and several other truth commissions. And after Marcy, Eugene Husky will be speaking. Professor Husky is a it's really a pleasure, an honor to be on the panel with you. I've read so many of your works. Professor Husky is the William R. Kennan Professor of Political Science and Russian Studies at Stetson University, and he has training in law and political science, and has written, many articles and books on Soviet and post-Soviet law, and other issues as well. Today we're going to be talking about the International Center for on Transitional Justice's findings from their trip in April, from their trip following the April violence in Kyrgyzstan, and the prospects for truth and transparency of truth-seeking commissions in Kyrgyzstan as a way of sort of leading that very, very troubled country into a constructive public debate about what's happened, about past abuses in Kyrgyzstan, and also what is happening in today's Kyrgyzstan. And I think this is an extremely relevant topic, especially given the events of this past summer in June, when there was terrible violence, ethnic violence between ethnic Uzbeks and ethnic Kyrgyz in southern Kyrgyzstan, and the difficulty, I think, that Kyrgyzstan has had in reconciling two extremely different narratives of what actually happened in the south. But I think we should go back about five steps and place all this into a kind of a broader context. And many of you, if you're here, it's because you know and you care about Kyrgyzstan, and you know that Kyrgyzstan is a strategically very important country because it's strategically important because of its it's strategically important for the West because of its proximity to Afghanistan and the importance of the Manas air base for U.S. forces in Afghanistan. It's strategically important for the Russians as well. It's the only country in Central Asia, I think it's probably the only country in the world where there are both Russian and U.S. Military base that hosts both Russian and U.S. military bases. It's an extremely it's a highly fragmented country in that there are big divisions between north and south. It's also an extremely ethnically diverse country. There's a large Uzbek minority in Kyrgyzstan. Obviously, an ethnic Kyrgyz majority. There are many Russian speakers who continue to live in Kyrgyzstan. It's one of the more ethnically, I think, diverse countries in the region. It's been a country marked by two political trends. First, it's been the country that has been kind of the most open in Central Asia since the breakup of the Soviet Union. It has been for the past 20 years a real haven for for human rights activists and journalists who have been who were persecuted in other parts of Central Asia. It has, you know, been sort of one of the more progressive legislations. It's been, you know, has had kind of the most open press in Central Asia. However, it is also one of the most probably the Central Asian country that's been sort of most rocked by instability, particularly in recent years. And if you know that in 2005, Kyrgyzstan's president since independence, Askar Akayev, was overthrown. In a bloodless coup in March, in something that was known as the Tulip Revolution, and Kurmanbekiev was brought to power. And there were many great hopes that that whereas Askar Akayev, who had been viewed as a democrat, had been viewed as very friendly to the idea of open societies, but who had grown who had developed a brittle and corrupt and increasingly repressive government. That there were hopes that when Bakiyev was brought to power, that there would be a return to reform, and those hopes were very, very quickly dashed. Corruption and kind of the capture of state resources and the rent-seeking behaviors on the part of the civil service and politicians sort of grew out of control. And in the last year of Bakiyev's rule, there was a real palpable crackdown on civil society, on journalists, on NGOs. I think as people in power tried to do their best to keep hold of resources, to keep their capture of resources, to prevent any kind of transparency over what money was going where, and therefore they were stifling the press, stifling NGOs, stifling any kind of alternative sources of information, and trying to stifle political movements as well. Things came to a head, as many of you know, in April when the political opposition, was trying to hold big meetings, big demonstrations, and were at a time when the government was also holding its own political kurultais, they're called, political assemblies. Thank you. And things came to a head when ahead of one of the opposition's planned demonstrations in Talas, an opposition leader was arrested, and there was a violent clash between protesters and police in Talas. And then in Bishkek, other opposition leaders were arrested, and that, as you know, brought people out to the streets, and which resulted in some more violent clashes, which ultimately led to Bakiyev's removal from flight from Bishkek, and then ultimately several weeks later, flight from Kyrgyzstan. There were many. I think that there were many grievances that brought the opposition to the streets. Grievances about the Bakiyev era, about corruption, about failure of state infrastructure, about rising prices, especially rising energy prices, about the persecution of opposition leaders. There was a real variety of grievances that brought people out to the street. And I think the grievances that I think still it's just not clear how or when they're going to be addressed, but they need to be addressed. And I think the concern is, now that he's out of office, I think there is a legitimate concern that as the government tries to address these grievances, that it address them in an impartial and thorough manner, and rather than in a manner that is sort of aimed at political retribution. I think there's a common strand between the kind of quest for real justice for what happened during the Bakiyev era, both in terms of corruption and human rights abuses and the like, with a common strand that ties that to what happened in the South this summer. I mean, where, as you know, the the overthrow of Bakiev and the violence between Kyrgyz, ethnic Kyrgyz and ethnic Uzbeks in the south are related. I won't get into how just here, but one definitely was the catalyst, the trigger for the other. But I think there again in the south, I think that there are real concerns about whether there is going to be whether there can be at this point a thorough, objective, impartial analysis and investigation into what happened in the south, where people are held accountable in impartial, fair trials. There's been, I think, tremendous concern, especially on Human Rights Watch's part and part of many of our colleague organizations, about the very perverse turn that justice has taken in the South. And I think that should be a real wake-up call for the international community to make sure that there are institutions and processes in place that can bring about justice in Kyrgyzstan, separate from or free of the kind of impassioned and impassioned violence that we've seen break out in the South in the context of trials, and also also the need to have justice separate from and free of a kind of the political the quest, the drive for political retribution. So that's why I think that International Center for Transitional Justice's efforts to find a way to have truth seeking, to find a way to have impartial investigation is especially important now. It's more important now than when you started, and I'm sure that when you started, you had no idea that your efforts would take on the salience that they have now. So I've talked for way too long. So let me turn the floor over to Hani.
Thank you. Okay, I should have, I think, start by thanking the Open Society Institute for putting together this wonderful panel. It's great to be on such a prestigious panel and also to have Rachel moderating. Goes back a few years. Nice to be with you again. I'd like to also thank OSI for the generous support to our center, the International Center for Transitional Justice. The center is nearly 10 years old. We'll celebrate next year. And OSI has definitely stayed the course with us and provided lots of support, and not just financially. As Rachel was saying, Kyrgyzstan has gone through, in the last 5 years, two popular uprisings, toppled governments, deepened social divisions and political divisions in the country. She's given the context very well, so I won't dwell on it too much, and I know others will get into it. But essentially, after the events in April, there were discussions between the ICTJ and OSI, and we were both coming to the view that an assessment might be useful, an assessment undertaken by ICTJ into whether a transitional justice approach might assist the country in dealing with the transition it's going through. And you might say, well, why ICTJ and why this type of an assessment? And to be clear, our assessment wasn't going to be an inquiry into the abuses, but more of an assessment into how Kyrgyzstan might address those abuses, looking both to the past and to the future. So I may say just a few words about transitional justice and ICTJ. The center was established, as I said, nearly 10 years ago with the aim of assisting societies, countries going through transition in dealing with the legacy of mass abuse, human rights abuse. Meaning in the sense of how societies can tackle the legacy of abuse to ensure a better future, to bring justice to victims, to ensure going forward respect for rule of law, respect for human rights. Justice for the victims can encompass a number of things. It's not just financial compensation or seeing people put on trial. It's a more holistic approach. The center in a sense, focuses on the policy options, the mechanisms, the tools that can be brought to bear that may help societies going through those periods. And some of the essential tools, I'll just run through a list in a way, include criminal justice, prosecution, holding people accountable, and the various forms they take, whether in international tribunals or hybrid mixed tribunals or domestic tribunals or such like. And that's often very important for victims to be able to see those most responsible for the mass atrocities and the violations to be held to account. But that by itself is often not enough. And this is where we talk about a more holistic approach. Often the full story is not developed in the courtroom. And often people want to know exactly what happened, if there are missing relatives. They want to know where they are. If they begin to understand what's been going on in the country, they want to know why it happened. So often people turn to truth-seeking mechanisms or truth commissions, as they've now been termed, as a way to get the broader picture, to understand exactly what happened. There's no more denial. There's an official body that's looking, investigating, and the report of a truth commission is very important in really laying down the full story and the root causes, often pointing to responsibilities. And truth commissions are also very important in that they also make recommendations, which are often a sort of a roadmap then for a transitional justice process. So that's another tool or another mechanism. Reparations for the victims is also another important tool. You know, often victims will feel that the state did this to them and that to a certain extent the state owes them for what happened to them. The victims themselves may feel their families or their children suffered because of their lengthy imprisonment or because they're incapacitated after torture or ill-treatment, or the breadwinner may have been killed in detention or disappeared. And so often reparations in a broader sense, reparations not just in terms of financial compensation, but in the wider sense, individual, communal, symbolic, an apology by the state in a way is a form of reparation. Looking after the children of a victim, free education or education benefits or health benefits are very important. The symbolic is very important, I should stress. Another area that's very important, especially as we talk about non-repetition and ensuring that we don't go back to where we were in the future, relates to institutional and legal reforms. Security sector reforms, and related to all of those, maybe one other area, and the list can grow, I'm giving really the broad ones, is around memory, memorialization, how society tackles that period, in what way it remembers it, that in some ways restores also dignity to victims. It may help unite society, it may help restore trust. So these are all some of the techniques that I think have become termed transitional justice going forward. And the center, again in a few sentences, tries to bring those techniques, those policy options to countries that are going through transition, working very closely with civil society but also with the policymakers and the governments. And essentially, we try to bring three key elements together. One is the context on the ground and the local expertise, and people know their situation better than anybody else and can really see what might work for them and what might not. And essentially, many of the techniques I've just mentioned need to be looked at in terms of which one can go before which one. And it depends and changes country by country. Each country has its unique experience. You know, we certainly wouldn't want to take an experience from one country and say copy it in another. But the local context and expertise helps to understand the situation. Within the institution, we have experts in the various techniques who have also been practitioners or have been involved in the application of some of these techniques around the world. But essentially, their role is also to be able to compare between the how the same technique, whether it's a truth commission or a tribunal or a reforms program or a reparations program, how it's operated in different countries, draw out best practices, the lessons to be learned, challenges to be thought about in advance, mistakes to be avoided, etc. Working quite often with the practitioners or bringing them from different countries together so that they can compare notes and together, in a way, set the standards. And the standards need to be standards that comply with international human rights standards. So that element is a little bit theoretical, a little bit analytical and comparative. And the third element is really bringing from the field practitioners who have been involved in implementing these tools or these mechanisms. So a new country going through a transition could quickly find itself with experts who can compare other experiences and draw lessons and point to them some of the other experiences that might be useful to learn about and to listen to. And then practitioners who have been directly involved in applying and can give practical lessons and can say these are the challenges we faced. And with hindsight may also be able to say, and actually with hindsight, you know, maybe we should have done it this way rather than this way. So maybe, you know, that's to your benefit. But of course, your situation is slightly different to ours. And of course, the actors on the ground, whether it's civil society or the policymakers. I may have gone on too long, but I thought it's useful to at least explain all of that before we jump into the actual assessment that was done. Essentially, when people were thinking about ICTJ doing an assessment, I think there was a focus on truth-seeking. And in essence, I think in all situations, and but particularly in this one, we emphasize the holistic approach. And as I said earlier, it's not that one mechanism will resolve all the problems. It's usually a combination. And within a country or a society, it's getting to know which are the ones that are needed to make this work. So from the very beginning, we were clear that we weren't coming in with an agenda of, you know, a truth commission. You know, does Kyrgyzstan need a truth commission or not? But it was more, let's look at the situation on the ground. Let's talk to the civil society, to policymakers, to academics, to others, and then look at the techniques that are available and try to point to making recommendations to what might be useful for them. There were some issues that came up again at the beginning, and I don't want to give the plot away and because we have distinguished experts who will talk about it, but clearly one of them was timing, and you know whether we were coming in maybe too early or maybe too late. You know, there was talk about the referendum and perhaps elections down the road. Maybe we should wait till things settle down before we go. It was still a little bit unclear. So we had to deal a little bit with those types of issues. It was also clear that the issues that were immediately percolating to the surface at the time were not related really to mass human rights violations, particularly where you're dealing with fundamental human rights like right to life or physical integrity. The issues that were really coming up much more were around, obviously, there were abuses by security services and, you know, widespread discrimination, but also there was corruption. There was issues around, you know, election fraud. You know, those types of issues were the ones that were coming up. So it wasn't immediately a neat fit with where ICTJ would normally be saying, You know, there's been a huge legacy of mass abuse, and we should be coming in to look at the situation. The team we put together, and again going back to what I was saying, comprised you know, Marcy Mirsky and actually Bogdan Ivanisevic, who's not with us today, he's out in the field. Both of them very extensive experts in transitional justice and having worked in a number of countries, and that was very important for the team. And then, of course, Professor Eugene Jean Husky, a political scientist who's been studying Kyrgyzstan for many years and has authored books and articles and would help the team look at the context. The report itself was released. The team went at the end of May, beginning of June, for a week, and the report was issued with recommendations in August. We did also, this was part of the context in the discussion, we did produce a Russian translation to be disseminated on the ground, and the team will talk a little bit about the thinking behind that, because much of the discussion also, I think, centers on the need to open up debates on the ground within civil society and between civil society and those now holding authority in the country. And the hope was that the report and the recommendations would begin some of those discussions on the ground and may take us forward. But I think I will stop there and hand over to the team. Thank you.
Hello. Good to be with you. It's actually a pleasure, and as my other colleagues have said, really an honor to be on this panel. And it was actually an honor to be on the team that went to Kyrgyzstan. It was a first for both Bogdan and myself to be in Central Asia. And it was probably deeply enriching, as enriching for ourselves to have that experience and to encounter similar problems in that context that we had faced in other parts of the world. So it was enriching for us, and we hope that, as Hani has just said, that the report that we produced as a team with Jean will be of some use on the ground to activists, to policymakers, to human rights defenders as they struggle to take their country forward. We did our work based almost entirely in doing interviews with a wide range of actors based in Bishkek. Because of the short time frame we had, we were on the ground for a week in Kyrgyzstan. We really didn't get a chance to travel to other parts of the country. We were deeply assisted by OSI on the ground, by the National Foundation in Kyrgyzstan, who set up a tremendous agenda for us. We did more than 30 interviews in those first 5 days. We met with virtually all of the major human rights and democratization organizations working from civil society. We also met with ministers of internal affairs and justice, the procurator general, and a presidential aide. And we also did meetings with the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, OECD, and the National Democratic Institute. So we covered a range of local civil society, government officials, and international actors on the ground in Kyrgyzstan. I'm going to cover a few of the general things and maybe take up some of the issues that Hani alluded to, and then talk a little bit more in detail about the Truth-Seeking Truth Commission part of our assessment and also on reparations. And Jean will look a little bit more in depth at the institutional reform issues and the case and criminal prosecution. And then we'll open it up to all your questions, and we'll see if we can answer any of them. So I wanted to come back to a couple of things. One is that we really were not a fact-finding mission. Right. We were not going to ascertain what had been happening. That's done so well by Human Rights Watch and others on the ground there. That we did need, though, to explore what was going on in order to have some sense of where transitional justice mechanisms might fit in to the general problems of the transition there. As Hani said, the initial request actually was more focused on truth-seeking, but we did believe firmly that a more holistic approach is probably more helpful. And so as a team, we examined especially for these four different mechanisms, the truth-seeking, reparations, institutional reform, and criminal prosecutions. That was the focus of our work on the ground. As Hani said, the first issue for us as a team, really, as an assessment team, was to figure out from a more, almost from a conceptual perspective, how to approach this country where there was not a history or pattern of massive violations, which is what human rights, transitional justice usually takes as its object of action. So we didn't have that pattern. And we also went before the outbreak of violence in the South. Our mission finished a few days before that. And very interestingly, actually, there were no signs of that to come. It was actually quite startling when we got back that no one had told us in any, given us any clues that the situation might unfold within days. It clearly didn't, it wasn't in the kind of, it wasn't on the horizon for people in terms of how they were seeing the problems in the country at that time. So anyway, we went into a situation and clearly when we say there was no pattern or history of massive violations of the most fundamental human rights, that changed some in the June events, but it doesn't really shift. We didn't believe it shifted entirely the situation that we were examining. What we did confirm, though, through these conversations and interviews with people, that there was a concern for an increasing tendency to repressive rule and the wide-scale abuse of state power by two consistent regimes for whom there had been hopes of democratization. So we found this tendency that people confirmed for us. And then we also explored with people what we called sites of impunity from their perspective. What were the major sites of impunity that needed to be addressed as part of their transition process? And those systematically for people were corruption, which had been part of what brought down the previous two regimes. System-wide abuses by law enforcement and justice sector institutions, and those abuses included systematic beatings of prisoners in pre-trial detention situations, some of that amounting to torture. We heard numerous indications of corruption in these law enforcement and justice sector institutions, that you could pay to have someone charged and pay to have charges taken away, and that there was no redress for that ever, and that there was systematic denial of those problems occurring within those institutions. Some people also had raised the question of electoral fraud, that people had felt defrauded in their vote, in their attempts to create a more democratic process. And that those issues needed to be discussed openly, and that there needed to be mechanisms put in place to deal with fraud. And then discrimination on religious and ethnic grounds, which tended to be also an increasingly important part of what people were looking at. And as a team, then, we came to believe that those, even though it poses a problem for transitional justice mechanisms because of the complexity of corruption issues, because of the complexities of dealing with systematic abuses in very important institutions, that if there were to be a transitional justice approach applied in Kyrgyzstan, it would be very, very important to consider broadening the scope to include, in addition to violations of the right to life and physical integrity, these other issues where people felt perhaps most directly in their daily lives the existence and the persistence of impunity and no rights to redress. At the time we were in Kyrgyzstan also, the civil society organizations were very much focused on the issue of transparency. Transparent action. They're demanding transparent action in the interim government and participation by civil society organizations on all levels in policy making, policy monitoring. And the focus was very, very much on those issues of transparency and good governance. At the same time, though, there was a general demand for accountability, accountability understood broadly. All of the organizations, virtually all that we talked to, emphasized a need for what you could call a depoliticized and transparent process of criminal prosecution. That is to say, what Rachel was mentioning in the case of not using trials as political retribution, but actually as a way of seeking justice broadly in a neutral fashion. So they all emphasized the need for prosecution. But at the same time, almost everyone also recognized that prosecutions needed probably to focus on those who had committed the worst crimes and at the highest levels. That prosecutions of those people would send a message more broadly in the society that this kind of action would no longer be acceptable. But there wasn't a demand for justice, that is the application of criminal justice at all levels. In fact, there was a certain recognition that because the problems are systemic, that is to say the abuses in the justice institutions, in the courts, in the procuracy, and in the law enforcement organizations, in the police, go up and down the chain. In some cases, the middle and lower level people who committed violations and who committed abuses didn't have a lot of choice, because that's simply how the system worked. And that it probably wasn't appropriate in some of those cases to bring them to criminal justice, that there would be other ways of doing this. They mentioned in particular questions of public acknowledgement of wrongdoing, that could have an enormous impact if justice sector officials would go public and say, we acknowledge that we've done this and this is how the system works. And that would be important. Some version of naming and shaming. These are the people who've been the worst abusers. And some forms of vetting could also be extremely helpful. So there was a sense that other forms of accountability in addition to criminal justice were actually appropriate. And we found this to be an excellent starting point for thinking about a transitional justice approach, which, as Hani says, looks at combining a variety of mechanisms to achieve accountability in different ways. So we thought that actually there was a good entrance point in general for taking a transitional justice approach. Specifically in terms of truth-seeking, or creating a truth commission. I think from my perspective, having worked on a couple of truth commissions, there need to be conditions on the ground to make them work. So I certainly, my colleagues didn't go in thinking this is something that Kyrgyzstan really needs, but rather really assessing what are those conditions and what would make it work here, what could potentially make it be a useful instrument. And what we've encountered first, I think, were maybe I want to mention three kind of important obstacles to thinking about a truth commission or to actually having a truth commission implicated. And one is that despite the fact that there's a very sophisticated community of civil society organizations working on human rights and justice issues, there's actually very little knowledge of transitional justice and in particular of truth commissions and how they've worked in other places. We tried to understand why there was that dearth of knowledge about truth commissions in such a sophisticated civil society community. And we think that maybe there are a couple of reasons. One is that there's just not much available on those experiences in Russian, and most of the folks are much more involved with Russian literature on these things. There's been no truth commission in a former Soviet republic or in a country under the Soviet sphere of influence. And so there's no nearby experience for people to draw on or to think this reflects in some way what our situation is. And then when people did have some knowledge of truth commissions, it was usually in the African or the Latin American context where there had been dictatorships and internal armed conflicts, civil wars, and they said, that's not us. So as a sense that this is really not something that we would do here necessarily because this isn't what we've been through. So there was a lack of knowledge of the specificity too of what a truth commission is in relation to other kinds of truth-seeking experiences. So that's one obstacle that persists. The other thing that came as we began to look at what experience is there on the ground with truth-seeking, there had been a number of commissions of inquiry into specific cases and specific events in Kyrgyzstan, some parliamentary, some civil society, one in particular led by the Human Rights Ombudsman. But for most part, people found them to be frustrating experiences. The commissions maybe didn't work well, or when they did work well, nothing came of their recommendations. There was a certain frustration with previous experiences of truth-seeking in the form of commissions of inquiry. So I think we think it'll be, actually, this is very much post-facto, but very important to see how the OECD-led commission of inquiry into the June events carries out its task, and how that's received by Kyrgyzstani society and policymakers. In particular, because there hasn't been before in Kyrgyzstan an international commission of inquiry into any of these events or cases. And there was a lot of hesitancy in our interlocutors to think about that. On the one hand, some people said it would be necessary to have neutrality and impartiality, but at the same time, a certain sense that we need to do it ourselves. That was a kind of and that's very common, actually. That's an often that dilemma or that tension between a national focus and needing perhaps some outside neutrality is something we see often in different places. But anyway, it will be very, very important to see how the OECD experience unfolds over the next couple of months. So, but there'd been this poor experience in the general, a lot of frustration. And then another obstacle was that we didn't encounter any civil society organization or important political party that was actually calling for a truth commission. And again, our own experience on the team is that the demand, that sometimes it's important, generally important for these to be demand-driven, and that civil society needs to be actively involved for the mechanisms for the experience to actually be fruitful. So there's these three pretty large obstacles that we found or constraints. But as a team, we came away convinced nonetheless, and despite our own caution on this point, that a truth commission could, in the Kyrgyz context, offer some really important potential advantages in strengthening their transition. And I want to mention three in particular. One is that truth commissions are different from commissions of inquiry often because they involve people broadly. They involve especially victims broadly, have a much larger potential of broadening the public sphere discussion of the abuses under investigation. And it seemed in Kyrgyzstan that that would be extremely important, to be able to open the public debate and to broaden the public sphere, and that there wasn't, despite the great work that the human rights organizations do on the ground, their work, as all human rights organizations around the world in countries where there are abuses, often don't have the public reach that they would like to have. And an officially sanctioned truth commission can broaden that public sphere and one's access to that public sphere. And also, in general, it would take the perspective and voices of victims into that public sphere, into that public, broadened public sphere. We also believe in the same context around the need to broaden the public discussion, to put these issues firmly on the table of human rights violations, politically motivated crimes, and serious abuses of power, that public hearings would be extremely useful in the Kyrgyz context. And they would be useful not only because they would take those people's voices, those victims' voices, into people's homes in the best of circumstances with media support, but they could also help to take the problems and the abuses out of a local context, a local and regional context, and put them firmly in a national space. And that people from different parts of the country, north and south, would be able to understand better that those abuses don't only occur in my community or in my region or to my people. But these are problems that affect all of us, sometimes differentially, but through which the entire nation has lived. So that the public sphere, the voices of the victims, and taking the problems out of a regional or local context onto the national debate is one area where we felt there was really important potential advantages in a specific context. A second was We found that the previous truth-seeking efforts, and most of the concern actually, was focused on specific cases and specific events. The April events, the NUCAT incident, the case of this journalist, now the June events. But we came away thinking that there was a need really to look at least ask the question, have the problems in Kyrgyzstan been isolated events and bad leaders, or is there something deeper and more structural at play here? And that a truth commission offers a fairly unique opportunity to look at that as a whole society, and that could be an important exploration of pattern and the systematic nature of abuse of power in the country. And a third reason that we came away thinking would be really important is that because of the tendency toward the a political regime that was increasingly restrictive of human rights and increasingly willing to use violence against opponents, that a truth commission in the context of the broad democratizing constitutional reform process that has gone on in the last months could help mark a clear before and after and say what is acceptable political practice and what is not. That probably won't come out of a commission of inquiry, but could come out of a truth commission. So we felt that despite the many obstacles on the ground, there were a lot of potential advantages to trying to see how at least to have a more informed discussion about the potential of a truth commission in the Kyrgyz context. And we can come back to more issues on that in the questions if you like. In terms of reparations, what we found in terms of experience is that there was a compensation program. Specifically, monetary compensation program had been developed and was really far, far advanced for the victims of the April uprising. That is, for the people, I think there were 86 deaths in the events that brought down the Bakiyev government, and that those victims had received monetary compensation. We found that there was general support among our interlocutors for that program, but there was also some concern that maybe it had been done for political ends, to sort of glorify those who had given their lives for the revolution that had taken place, and that there had been some proposals, even when we were on the ground then, to broaden the compensation program to include victims of other human rights violations that had occurred in the previous couple of years. In no cases were people really looking at a more holistic approach to reparations either. So the discussion had really been to date just on the monetary compensation and not looking at any of the symbolic forms of reparations that have been found to be very important in other places as well. Clearly, after the June events, the issue of reparations and who needs to be part of that needs to be readdressed. And we came away thinking that it was important to try and consider a single reparations program tied to a truth-seeking effort, a broader truth-seeking effort, and a single reparations program because it could help to diminish the risks of politicization, of using it as a political tool to compensate friends of a political project and leave out those who might not have been. And because to send the message that no victims of the same violations or abuses are more worthy of reparations than others. It's sort of international best practices as well that the reparations on the right to reparations for all victims of gross violations independent of their specific characteristics. But this hadn't been thought of. We hadn't seen an approach to this. Clearly, my guess is that after the June events, there's more discussions going on now about a full-blown reparations program. We also found that there'd be a need to place special attention on the question of access for women to reparations, that even in the limited compensation problem, there had been some problems for women to have easy access to the process. In fact, the cases which had been taken to the courts to resolve were all involved women, who oftentimes questions around marriage. Whether the marriage had been recognized in civil processes or whether there was a religious component or not to that marriage was often an issue. So anyway, we thought it was important to stress the need for access to women and for dealing in an adequate fashion with gender-based violations, which hadn't really been looked at. Preparations, just very briefly, that. And I wanted to end by saying that I think we came away as well with thinking that no matter what's done, that questions of process and how these mechanisms would be put into place were fundamental in Kyrgyzstan, and probably as important in some ways as any other aspect, whether it be the scope of what's looked at in a truth commission. And this was because of the widespread distrust that we found, the lack of confidence in government and in political leadership, the poor prior experience that people had with some similar initiatives, and because of current demands for transparency and participation, that the process would need to be as inclusive as possible and to ensure really adequate consultation on the scope of things. If there were to be a truth commission on issues of selection of commissioners, where we found a lot of comment, well, how would you find people here who could actually be impartial? And on in the question of reparations, particularly around the question of what are appropriate forms of material and symbolic reparations, and how to create a proper balance from the perspective of the victims of those forms of reparations. I'll pass over to Jean now and leave it at that. We can come back to some of these issues.
Thanks, Marcy and Rachel and Hani, and thanks in particular to ICTJ and Lisa and everyone else involved for bringing in a country specialist into the transitional justice area. This has been a very steep learning curve for me. I can't claim that I'm very far up the curve yet. It was a great experience to be in Bishkek with two persons who had real expertise. We wish we had Bogdan here today, because I'm going to be speaking on, in part at least, institutional reforms and on criminal prosecution. Marcy's given a masterful overview of what we found generally on the ground, the potential value of transitional justice mechanisms, and she's focused mainly on truth commissions and on the reparation side. And I'm going to talk, partly because it's my own background as well in Soviet and post-Soviet law, a little bit about criminal prosecutions and institutional reform. I want also to finish up by talking about the political environment now in Kyrgyzstan and its appropriateness for the use of transitional justice mechanisms, to get to some of the issues that Hani was talking about relating to the timing and sequencing of the use of transitional justice mechanisms. One of the first things I think to remember about Kyrgyzstan is that it's a post-Soviet state. It's almost 20 years since the Soviet Union collapsed, but Kyrgyzstan and many other post-communist countries are still heavily influenced by legacies from the Soviet era. We saw that in the wake of the October 10th elections in Kyrgyzstan when, as you may know, four out of the five party leaders traveled to Moscow for consultations virtually on the next day. We also see it in the institutional legacies in the legal system, where the Soviet model of justice continues to shape attitudes and behavior. One of these legacies is the politicization of justice, which turns formal judicial, or at least formally independent judicial institutions, into tools of the political leadership of the day. Traditions like telephone justice assure judicial submissiveness, which permits executive officials to use the legal system to consolidate their personal power, to settle political scores, and to target marginalized groups for persecution. Marcy mentioned the Nokat incident in the south of Kyrgyzstan in 2008, where 30-odd observant Muslims were celebrating the end of Ramadan and were in a public place and were in fact brought to trial for that and convicted and subject to torture and other humiliations. Judicial submissiveness then has been evident in a wide range of cases, from overtly political cases like the Constitutional Court decisions that effectively paved the way for the consolidation of authoritarianism by Bakiyev in 2007, to the disqualification of opposition candidates standing for office, the electoral, if not electoral fraud, the electoral impediments that we've seen that Hani mentioned. The challenge for Kyrgyzstan, though, goes beyond these legacies from the Soviet era. the post-communist era itself has generated its own set of institutional problems, or it's exacerbated problems that it's inherited from the Soviet era. The most serious of these is corruption, which is far worse today than before independence, owing to the erosion of the checking mechanisms of the Soviet era, the kind of value system. One may be critical of the Soviet era, but it had a set of values that people adhered to, at least many people adhered to, and also the partial and rather bizarre and distorted privatization of the economy that's taken place in Kyrgyzstan and other parts of the post-communist world. So justice in Kyrgyzstan has not only been politicized, it's been for sale. And so I think that it's both political corruption, or rather legal corruption, and the politicization of justice that has facilitated the impunity that has been so widespread in Kyrgyzstan and elsewhere. I would argue, although I know that doesn't fit in with the transitional justice literature neatly, that corruption in recent years in the police, prosecutor's office, and the courts has resulted in a systematic and widespread violation of human rights, where innocent persons were targeted for prosecution in order to extort money, and guilty persons were let off because they paid bribes. This large-scale lack of justice for victims and perpetrators undermines the authority of the state, and in some cases it's contributed to inter-ethnic violence. I think there are many causes, and we can talk about them in question time if you want, to what happened in the South. But part of the increasing tension was the targeting of Uzbek businessmen by the new prosecutorial staff that came in under the interim government in April and May and early June that simply exacerbated an already bad situation. Now, let me talk briefly about what's being done in the area of institutional reform, or what has been done since the interim government came in April. The record of the interim government in the legal realm is decidedly mixed, but it's taken some important first steps in institutional reform in the legal system. These include, as you would read in the report, the elimination of the Ninth Department of the Ministry of Internal Affairs, the MVD, which was targeting political opposition in the Bakiyev era. It has significantly increased salaries for the police. It's turned over personnel in the MVD, including all the deputy ministers, all of the regional heads, and a quarter, at least that was the report when we were there in early June, of the district police chiefs. The new constitution, approved in late June, strengthens the independence of the judiciary by shifting the power of appointing court chairs from the president to the judges themselves. This is an issue that it seems a very minor one, but it's an extremely important mechanism for the creation of what has been called in Russia a power vertical, the, in a way, subordination of the courts and other legal institutions to the executive. Judges are appointed for life, so how do you control them? You control them in part by making sure that the court chairs who reward ordinary judges, who promote them, and who assign cases are in the pockets of the executive. They are not given life tenure as court chairs. They are given short-term appointments. And so what Kyrgyzstan has done in its new constitution, which is very positive, is to have those court chairs elected by the judges themselves. That sort of change can make a very big difference. It's also improved the judicial selection system by altering the composition of the nominating bodies, which propose judicial nominees for presidential approval. These boards will now have a third nominated by the parliamentary majority, a third by parliamentary minority, and a third by civil society organizations, including people from the legal community. Perhaps the most contested area of institutional reform in Kyrgyzstan remains the vetting of existing personnel in the legal system. And I would say that to this point, the policy of the interim government has been disappointingly ad hoc. We constantly heard in June that there were proposals in place to vet the judges, especially after elections were held. No one seemed to have any firm details on that. Then in midsummer, under severe pressure from one of the deputy leaders of the interim government, Azimbek Beknazarov, President Atumbayeva signed a decree which simply dismissed out of hand over 20 judges at several levels of the judiciary. I was in Bishkek, in fact, and had dinner with her at the end of July, it would have been, when she was contemplating this decision. And I begged her to introduce, as I think transitional justice would hold is proper, a careful, transparent, systematic review of the judges before they were dismissed. But she was under enormous pressure, especially, as I said, from Beknazarov. This was a very loose coalition of people. Rosa Otunbayeva, the president, was not a strong figure in this. I think she was probably, arguably, one of the weaker of the five top people in the government. And so she, in my view, bent to this kind of pressure. There's now a serious debate in Kyrgyzstan, literally this week, over the way forward on matters of vetting. One civil society group recently formed in order to introduce a law on lustration through referendum, which would require the gathering of 300,000 signatures. It's interesting, this is an organization called Narodne Dvizhenie Lustratsii, Popular Movement of Lustration. It emerged in 2009 under Bakiyev to try to get rid of many of the worst and most corrupt people in the old regime. They were immediately arrested and prosecuted. They are now free, and now they are wanting to do the same thing under the new regime. They've collected 15,000 signatures. They hope that with that 15,000 that Otunbayeva will then put it on the agenda as a bill before Parliament. It's unlikely that's going to take place, and they're probably going to have to get 300,000 signatures and put it before a popular referendum. There's already been yesterday a pushback from Almazbek Atambayev, who was the head of the Social Democratic Party, a person who may become the prime minister, we don't know, over the next 2 days, who said that he does not want to have lustration. He's very much against this policy. One other point on personnel reform. The issue is not just removing corrupted and politically compromised officials, but redressing the ethnic imbalance in law enforcement organs. Police, prosecution, and the armed forces are almost exclusively ethnic Kyrgyz, although almost 30% of the population are from minority groups, and half of that percentage are Uzbeks. About 15% of the total population in Kyrgyzstan are Uzbeks. So a policy of de-indigenization of personnel in this sector is crucial if one wants to prevent the events in Osh from repeating. And you have to ask yourself whether or not if there had been a different kind of ethnic balance in legal institutions, in the police and elsewhere, if you would have had the deterioration of the situation that you had on the ground in the south in June. A quick point on one other transitional justice mechanism, criminal prosecution. As in all regimes in transition, the prosecution of corrupt officials from the old order is highly charged politically. To this point, most of the people prosecuted have been high-profile persons who were closely associated with President Bakiyev's family and who were accused of massive fraud or theft, who basically took out of the country, some would say, hundreds of millions of dollars. Much of that actually taken from a $300 million loan, or some say was a grant, that Russia gave to Kyrgyzstan in the early part of 2008. The recent conviction of Bakiyev's nephew, which happened, I think, just earlier this week, is an example of this. The trickier question now for the Public Prosecutor's Office, which is now headed by Kubatbek Baybolov, a person I think who is more progressive, if that's quite the term, a better candidate for the post than the Procurator General that we interviewed in early June. His office, as I understand it, has sufficient evidence to bring criminal charges against numerous leaders of political parties that have gained seats in Parliament. And in fact, they had that evidence during the campaign itself, as I understand it. They have not yet prosecuted these individuals, apparently for fear earlier of disrupting the elections, or maybe even now igniting a civil war, because many of these prosecutions would be brought, I think, against southern, prominent southern politicians. And the question now is whether there will be criminal prosecutions against those who figure prominently in the new political establishment. I gave you a table, and I hope you'll have it there. There are two of them. One, a rather curious one on the backgrounds of party leaders. Most of it will be kind of uninteresting, but there is one column, not employed, where you see that 50% of the member of not the members, these are the people who were of the 120 people on the party list. This is a proportional representation system. 50% of them, временно не работает, temporarily are not working. Now, I think generally there's two explanations for this. They're temporarily not working. One is that they're engaging in criminal activity that they can't report. They're somehow, their livelihood depends on a business that they don't want to identify. Or, and to be fair, there is something of this. These were people who were tied to the former regime. And they're struggling to find a new place in it. And they're sort of biding their time until the elections took place and they can find a new landing point, as they say in Russian. Запасной аэродром. They need to have something in place for themselves. So I think probably that party, at least the rumors have it, would be the one that might be most targeted. That would be the most politically explosive thing to do. So criminal prosecutions, once we move beyond a particular circle related to Bakiev and his family, become politically, again, very, very sensitive. Okay, to the question of is this the time to expand the use of transitional justice mechanisms in Kyrgyzstan, recognizing that we already have one in place on an international level? It seems to me that the answer depends on the mechanism employed. If we're speaking about the formation of a truth commission that could reveal the causes of systematic corruption, widespread human rights violations, and the country's ungovernability in recent years, then perhaps some patience is in order. I don't disagree that if the country is to learn lessons from the two revolutions over the last 5 years, an abortive coup, and inter-ethnic violence, then clearly a broader truth commission, in my view, is warranted. But the issue is timing. I would argue that two things probably have to happen before such a commission should become a matter of serious debate. First, the International Commission on the OSH events will need to issue its report, and the receptiveness of society to that exercise will need to be gauged. Second, the new ruling coalition will need to establish itself as an effective governing force, and that also is probably going to take about 3 or 4 months. So my sense is that perhaps early in the year, January, February, that one may be able to talk seriously, once one has gauged that reaction, about expanding the use of truth commissions. For use for reasons, as I suggested, of short-term political stability, it may also be premature to launch criminal prosecutions against party leaders, or at least those individuals who have become prominent in politics, whether they're in the government or in the opposition. At some point, however, those guilty of crimes should be brought to justice. But it's not too early right now, in my view, to begin institutional reform. And as I suggested, on several fronts, that initiative has already started. There's a need now to ensure that it is systematic as opposed to ad hoc, and that it is informed by best practices so that it is both effective and legitimate. A method for the gradual vetting of police, prosecutors, and judges, something that might take a year or two, and benefit from international expertise and funding should be introduced as soon as possible. Now, let me finish up very briefly with a political kind of comment here. What's the likely shape of the new ruling coalition? We may know tomorrow, we may know 2 days, so speculation at this time may be a little bit silly. But if you look at the table, we have 5 parties that have representation. It's essential to have 3 of them in order to form a ruling coalition, in order to form the 61 seats that it would take. The two most likely, the most likely right now, is a coalition between the Social Democratic Party and Respublika. They've already reached a tentative arrangement, And now the efforts are, as we understand it, to bring in Atta McKen. This would be, I think, I'm not sure one should call it a dream team from the perspective of the West, but it would be less bad, perhaps, than some other options. There are reports that Atta McKen, they're having a difficult time bringing in Atta McKen, whether or not this is because of resistance from Russia or resistance from Tekebayev, the head of the Atta McKen party itself, it isn't clear. But let me say that the new constitution, one of the very positive things about it, that I think is going to have implications for the working of legal institutions and other institutions, is that it fragments power, and it gives considerable authority to the opposition. In that way, it's rather like the U.S. system, for all of its flaws, in that the opposition, whoever goes into the opposition, is going to have the chairmanships of two important committees on the budget and on law and order. And so it's a system that really does force compromise. There is, of course, the problem, the potential problem of stalemate. Compromise and cooperation has to be in much larger supply than it has been in Kyrgyzstan. We're talking about Kyrgyzstan here and not the United States, than it has been over recent years. And I think one of the other things that we have to be careful of is pressures from the outside, that there are larger, more authoritarian countries surrounding Kyrgyzstan that have applied pressure over recent years. And if the ruling coalition is to become a stable and effective one, we have to make sure that foreign countries from wherever they are not unduly pressuring the government of the day or setting one group in Kyrgyzstan against the other. Okay, I'll stop there.
Well, thank you, Jean, Marcy, and Hani. That was a really stimulating presentation. I have one quick, maybe not so quick question, and then we can open the floor to questions. I guess the question is to you and Marcy and to you, Jean. When you talk about the essence of transitional justice would be, I paid very close attention to the three points that you made about having a public sphere, bringing victims' voices to the public sphere, and taking the ability of a process to take people's grievances out of their regional or highly localized contexts. What's your prognosis for the possibility of a process like that in today's Kyrgyzstan, or say even in a couple of months, when in Jean's from Jean's perspective, it would be appropriate and timely? What's the prospect for that, given sort of where the country is right now, which is highly fragmented, angry and frustrated? I'd be interested to hear whether you've, in your work in Guatemala or in other places where you've worked, whether you've seen truth commissions operate in similar circumstances where there was this similar or analogous fragmentation, analogous levels of frustration and anger. That's the first question. And the second, relatedly, what do you think the chances are? I guess this is really for you, Professor Husky. What do you think the chances are for a process like this to be able to take place without it being captured by a nervous political elite, trying to capture it and control it, mold it, manipulate it? So maybe first.
Well, I mean, I think this has to be an international commission. It's not going to work if it's a national commission. We've had one of those already. In fact, it was meeting when we were there in June. In fact, there have been two now, one to deal with the April events and one with the Osh events and Southern events. And it's important to have the objectivity, the expertise, and the spotlight that an international commission would bring. I think without that, it clearly would be divisive. And you're absolutely right about the depth of the division in the country, particularly north-south. And I think in many ways, the north-south Kyrgyz division is, I think you were suggesting earlier, Rachel, is the more serious of the two, even though the ethnic one led to massive violence. There was a public opinion survey done a few weeks ago that I know you probably saw, where they ask respondents what the role was of the interim government in causing the events in Osh, the responsibility of the interim government, which is seen by people in the South as primarily controlled by Northerners. 40% of the Southerners said that the interim government was responsible in some significant way. 1% of people in the North, a 40-to-1 margin. I don't think many societies have that kind of chasm. So I think you're absolutely right about the potential for misunderstanding. But if it's given to an international commission, if there is that sense of fairness, and I think inevitably, in my view, there will be blame to go around for northern and southern politicians, even if there is a little bit more attributed to one side or the other, I think that will help to soften the blow, if you want. But it is a difficult moment to do this. I don't disagree.
Okay.
Good. Just, or at least to problematize, yeah, rather than to disagree entirely, because we certainly did get the sense of the fragmentation, which is clearly worse than we perceived it to be, and which has grown worse the past months. There's only been one truth commission, I think, and other of my colleagues can correct me, that has been fully international, which was in the case of El Salvador many years ago. And at least in the Latin American context, it's probably been in some ways the least taken up by society, the least referred to, the least gone back to, and the least kind of incorporated into what people talk about in terms of Truth Commission experiences. So I think that needs to be taken into account. And in general, the more participatory the process can be, the more people feel it's their story, obviously. It's almost a truism in some ways. So that while the issue of having international participation in a truth commission might be fundamental, might be very important in the Kyrgyzstan context, there are balances that have to be thought about in how it would then insert itself. And I think it will be very interesting to see what comes out of the OECD-led experience now, the International Commission now, and how. But again, there's another difference as well, and though that the two commissions so far have been event-based and not looking more broadly at a 10 or 15-year period, at a whole range of abuses, exploring patterns and both institutional and perhaps individual responsibilities. So the kind of different processes in some ways. I think, though, just to add another dimension, I don't think it's as simple as a 3 or 4 month waiting period to see how things consolidate. One of the major obstacles I think that we encountered was this lack of demand for a truth commission. That is to say, right now, it wouldn't be driven by a demand from the society, from victims, from civil society organizations, from human rights groups. And that what is actually needed at this point is to open some discussion about whether this would work in Kyrgyzstan, an informed discussion about whether this could work. What would it mean to us? That there could be some appropriation of the idea. Right now, it wouldn't work. Clearly, if it's something that's only declared by a coalition of political parties in the parliament, it will be doomed to fail. Doomed to fail and make the situation worse. So that I think the real question is there a way from the demand for accountability to help people to think through what would be the most appropriate and helpful ways to move forward toward accountability in this particular context? And I think these need to be, in many cases, socially driven. And that's really the issue for me. Is there a role for the international community in terms of promoting this discussion? Are there people on the ground who actually are more engaged with these issues than that we found at the time or who would be now? And that would be the important, one of the really fundamental issues to look at is how to contribute to generating some sort of social process around these kinds of mechanisms.
Could I just, I mean, I think actually it's a very good point that we've had event-based truth commissions and non-event-based that focus on the pathologies, the broader kind of pathologies of the system, I think would in fact be less divisive. I think that you wouldn't have the kind of reaction, popular reaction, that you might to one on the Osh events or on the April events, where it really is couched in regional and ethnic terms, as opposed to political, legal, economic, systemic terms. So I think that the other point that it makes things difficult, and Marcy will correct me here perhaps on this, what we heard on the ground was that it was difficult to imagine for our local interlocutors, people from the civil society community especially, the kind of towering figures, the figures with the great authority that could be trusted to speak for the nation or could be trusted by various segments of the society. There wasn't anyone comparable now to, let's say, Chinggis Aitmatov in 1991 or 1992, who himself lost his luster in the later part of his life. Found it very difficult, don't you think, to come forward with names like that? And I don't know if that would pose a problem for a national commission.
Questions from the floor? Do you want to, Ed Klein, could you say your name, please? And you're Ed Klein of the Sakharov Foundation. Could you say your name and affiliation, please?
Let me take the in the reverse order that you asked them, if I could, because they're easier that way. We'll get to the last one, and I may actually pass it to Marcy at that point. There is a state law, state language, which is Kyrgyz, and there's an official language, which is Russian, which is the language of inter-ethnic communication, because a lot of people don't speak Kyrgyz. Even ethnic Kyrgyz who were raised in the city in the Soviet era, oftentimes, as in Kazakhstan, don't necessarily speak their so-called native tongue. The courts tend to use Kyrgyz or Russian, and that's a bit of a problem for Uzbeks. In fact, the Uzbeks have resented greatly the lack of language rights. It's very difficult. This is not Kyrgyz and Kazakh, where it is mutually intelligible. So there's a greater divide, and so Russian tends to be the language that's used. Sharia law is not in place, and it will not be in place unless there is a revolution even grander than the sort that we've seen over the last 5 years. In fact, there was a debate during the constitutional drafting process about whether or not Kyrgyzstan should be called a secular state, which it had been before. And there's an 80-person constitutional assembly, and there were a couple of representatives from the Muslim community, the observant Muslim community, who favored calling this a sort of Muslim society. They were overwhelmingly rejected in that. So going several steps further and introducing Sharia law would be out of the question altogether. The other issue is whether or not the findings of a truth commission would bolster the judiciary in some way. Marcy is much better qualified to tackle that question. I mean, I could certainly imagine that if you are looking at corruption, you are going to reveal patterns of behavior that may have institutional kind of responses that could improve the situation. So it's possible that a full-fledged truth commission that looks at electoral fraud, that looks at disqualification of candidates, that looks at corruption in the legal system, might generate conclusions that could then lead to institutional reforms. And I think those kinds of things happened elsewhere, but I'll let the TJ people.
I think that's pretty much the answer. And the relationship between a truth commission, which is a non-judicial body, it's an ad hoc non-judicial body, and its relationship to the criminal justice system has varied in different places with different experiences. I think initially, in the earliest experiences, generally there was a fairly clear separation, but over time, there's been an increased tendency, for example, for a truth commission actually to prepare cases and to hand those cases over to the justice system that they consider to be paradigmatic or particularly important cases. And also, in a number of places, even where there was a clear separation between a truth commission and the criminal justice system, a clearer separation, truth commission findings have been introduced as evidence in courts later. The findings have been. So there can be that way of bolstering, that is to say, part, even though it's not criminal investigation as contextual evidence or documentary evidence, it can also be used. And I think Jean probably hit on the key by one of the keys to this is that by looking at patterns and the systematic nature of violations, whether they be classic sort of human rights violations or other kinds of abuses of power, you can lay a framework for more effective legal reform by laying this bare. So I think there's a number of different ways in which, if done in a thoughtful manner, that you can actually bolster the justice system through a truth commission. I wanted to come back to the question of leadership because in the Guatemalan case, it was actually an interesting one. There was one international and two nationals. There was one commissioner appointed by the Secretary General of the UN, and then there were two Guatemalans, neither of them really who were famous, frankly, but they were honest. And I can't believe that there's not two or three honest.
I think there are.
Right. So I think that, and then they build through their work, they can build their reputation. And I think that that's one way of approaching the question about it. And that would be one of those things you'd want to talk about with people.
Okay. I'm wondering if you mean the June events as opposed to the April events, the OSHA events in June. I think we have to find, there are two places to go, many places to go, obviously, for the origins of the OSHA events. As a triggering mechanism, leaving aside the deeper interethnic tensions that have existed between Kyrgyz and Uzbeks as sedentary versus nomadic people for a long time, other kind of structural issues would be the natural tendency in new states coming out of empires, as Rogers Brubaker tells us, to try to push their own nationalizing agenda, the Kyrgyz. He calls it nationalizing nationalism. That is a natural kind of project when they feel that their language and their culture has been suppressed, as it was in the Soviet era, to some extent, over the preceding decades. On the other hand, the Uzbeks in Kyrgyzstan they're better off than the Kyrgyz financially. They are seen by the Kyrgyz to have their own country across the border. And so the Kyrgyz have a bit of a feeling that, wait a minute, Uzbeks have Uzbekistan. We want to have Kyrgyzstan as our own, and we don't want to have to make concessions. The Uzbeks, to some extent, look down on the Kyrgyz as people who are less sophisticated, less civilized, and all the rest of that. So those sorts of contextual...
There's an urban-rural thing.
And an urban-rural thing as well, absolutely. So all of that sort of is in the background. And then you have the April Revolution, which disturbs the political balance. And in one of the events that's not reported on as much, at least in the larger press, is what happened in May. There was an abortive coup in May where the pro-Bakiyev forces, the forces allied to the previous president who had just been deposed a month earlier, in a way seek to retake control. And they start this, as you might expect, in Bakiyev's home region, in Jalalabad. The national government finds it very difficult to put this down because the local police, local law enforcement officials are essentially pro-Bakiyev. Because they can't rely on their own officials, they mobilize the local Uzbek community led by a very well-known Uzbek, Kadirjan Baturov. And they helped to put down this revolt. And in so doing, they burned the houses down of Bakiev and some of his relatives. This is a very dividing moment, it seems to me. You know, here it goes from kind of north-south Kyrgyz to, you know, Uzbek Kyrgyz. So the Osheviks, which come a month later, that had been building. There had also been, and this is interesting, in 1990, the previous major example of violence between ethnic Kyrgyz and Uzbeks, where also several hundred people died in the south. Preceding that, I went back and was looking at the reports from not too long ago, the Uzbeks were making increased claims for autonomy, for language, the elevation of the Uzbek language. Exactly the same things were happening by Batyrov and others in the Uzbek community following the April Revolution, because this was an opportunity, this was a window of demanding improvements in the conditions for the Uzbek. That alienated ethnic Kyrgyz. So you take all of those things, and then you have whatever kind of spark occurred in Osh in the middle of June, which, let me say, we still don't know. Maybe Rachel has a better feel for this than I do, but I've heard so many different accounts that I'm anxiously awaiting the results of the International Commission to see what they find.
I think that your analysis is absolutely accurate about the longer term resentments and ethnic Kyrgyz. I would just add to that mix, I think, something that we had been mentioned before, and that was that there was a resentment on the part of ethnic Uzbeks that while they have economic power, they didn't have political. Political power had been cut off to them, both in the civil service and the civil service and the law enforcement and security structures, and I think also in electoral politics. Having said that, though, I think that the Uzbek community, the ethnic Uzbek community, had also been rather, apolitical. I don't know that there had necessarily been that much of a demand to have a role in high-profile electoral politics. They had been pretty much stayed out of the political fray, and I think that it was incendiary for the interim government to turn to Batyrov to form a political alliance, and it was probably rather unprecedented, and it sort of ended this what had I think many many years of political inactivity on the part of the ethnic Uzbek community. In terms of, I don't think I can really shed a whole lot of light on what was the spark that set everything off in June. I think that there are, I think you and I both know what the theories are, which one is more. I haven't seen any, documentary or other circumstantial evidence that would favor one theory over the other, whether it was Bakiya's people, whether it was related to the drug, I think one of the most popular theories is that the drugs mafias, during the period of chaos right after the interim government had been Bakiya had been toppled, were having a field day with rooting drugs, narcotics through Kyrgyzstan, and that the unrest was stirred up by drug lords in order to continue that ease of access. I have no idea whether that's true. I haven't seen the documentary evidence proving that. And there are other theories. The interim government for a while was claiming that there was some kind of mix between, one day it was, Islamic radicals and the IMU, and another day it was all, it was all Bakiyev, so you could have your pick. There was no lack of pet theories. But the long-term resentments, are there. The language issue also, I think one of the, you started to see, I think in May, newspaper articles about how why isn't the draft constitution published groups. Why wasn't the draft constitution published in Uzbek language? And I think that was perceived, I think, by ethnic Kyrgyz as something really threatening and frightening. You know, and you started to see, that interpreted by some ethnic Kyrgyz, you know, maybe more radical, orators and thinkers as, well, this is the first step towards their desire to sort of break off from, form their own sort of autonomous region in Kyrgyzstan, and we can't allow that to happen. I mean, I don't think that's terribly representative, but you started to see some people saying things like that. I mean, that really, really touched a very, very raw nerve.
And one of the frustrating things is those people that we had known for years, I mean, ethnic Kyrgyz, very well-educated, very moderate people, when you would raise this subject, they all of a sudden became so impassioned and almost irrational. They were not able to discuss it as scholars, but they were discussing it as ethnic Kyrgyz. It was very worrying.
I think you saw in both the press in both languages. When I say press, I mean, it's kind of a very elastic term, right? When you say press in the sheets, the bulletins or whatever, pretty radical things being said by both sides.
Did you also have a question about north-south differences in the Kyrgyz, just the Uzbek? Okay. Sorry. Russia is a big player, as I suggested, but in some ways the more worrying players for Kyrgyzstan are their immediate neighbors of Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan. When the April Revolution occurred and there was unrest, the Kazakhs closed the border, and the Kazakhs kept the border closed for months. And the Kazakh, I remember riding along it in late July and being stunned along the Chui River. There's now a huge fence separating Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, which you never had before. And that was devastating to the Kyrgyz economy. So Kazakhstan has had and has occasionally used the ability to cut off the trade links between a small country, one-third the size, basically, in terms of population, and far smaller in terms of GDP, and squeeze it. Uzbekistan has other mechanisms for causing trouble, whether it's border issues with the border troops. They have mined parts of the border, as you may know, in order to prevent IMU guerrillas, that's the theory, from moving across from the south, from Afghanistan. They have occasionally cut off natural gas supplies to Kyrgyzstan during the winter time, the most difficult time to do it. Now, that has to do in part with whether or not the Kyrgyz are actually paying their bills for natural gas, but it's part of a bigger set of tensions.
It's a Ukraine-Russia,
except the difference is that Kyrgyzstan has a lot of water that it sends down in a way free of charge to Uzbekistan, and Uzbekistan has its ideas about when it wants the water. It wants it for spring and summer, sowing and growing seasons, and the Kyrgyz want the water to go through the turbines in the winter to be able to produce electricity when they need it. So there are those kinds of economic tensions where there are levers of influence that Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan have, and they have occasionally used. There's a number of territorial problems. One of the strange things that I found, I didn't know this at all as a Sovietologist, before the Soviet Union collapsed, that there was not just a border dispute between Soviet Union and China, which you've read about and goes back decades. There are imprecise borders between the republics, particularly they're only now being delimited officially. That's ongoing, so that creates numerous tensions. Plus, as Rachel will know, you've got various enclaves of little pieces of Uzbekistan and Tajikistan sitting inside Kyrgyzstan. And those are sources of conflict. And in fact, there have been, over the last 3 months, it was in May, there was a direct kind of confrontation between Uzbek and Kyrgyz forces out in the Batken region. So,
Hani?
I was going to, actually going back to the question of timing and, you know, truth commission or not, should we wait, etc. I mean, clearly one of the findings that came out of from the study is the dearth of information on truth commissions and on transitional justice as a whole, and part of the reason the report is translated and is now being disseminated on the ground is to try to begin some discussions, but also tease out a little bit what more information people need. And to a certain extent, you know, this is in a way a question to OSI, but also to our distinguished experts. You know, to what extent should we be using the time to be trying to see what more information is needed? You know, people, I mean, in other situations are often wanting to know more about, and here it's a question both of expertise but also translations, you know, wanting to know more about other experiences around the world in more detail about some of the mechanisms, etc. You know, I've seen it often, you know, people hear, you know, the South Africa Truth and Reconciliation Commission as though that's the one example and that's the model, and if they don't like it, then they don't like, you know, truth commissions. And clearly, you know, that isn't the only model, nor does anyone say it's the best model, etc. So there's a little bit of thinking, you know, maybe tracking if there is really a genuine debate going on, if the report is circulating, what questions are coming up. We unfortunately, you know, don't have a presence on the ground, but I know OSI does have an office and can play a bit of that sort of a role of an eyes and ears on the ground. The other comment I wanted to make was really, Ed, your point about Sharia, and I, you know, I take your point that it's obviously not official and formal, but, you know, behind your question, I think, was the concern that would these processes work in a Muslim society or where Sharia prevails. And I wanted to draw your attention to a very robust truth commission experience in Morocco that happened between 2003 and 2006, where these issues did come up. You know, the truth commission did its work on disappearances and on torture of detainees. There were exhumations. They brought in religious scholars to make sure this could be done properly. In the recommendations, they instituted a huge reparations program. Again, working with religious scholars, they were able to ensure women got directly compensated, you know, that it didn't go through the male relative or the father of the victim, etc. You know, the bottom line being, in a way, that discussion had been happening in Morocco, and clearly, you know, they found their way and actually did it without having to break rules or run into problems with Sharia or religious scholars. So it really shouldn't be a problem to that extent in Kyrgyzstan.
Certainly, I mean, you've actually raised a question that's a focus of considerable debate, which is the question of whether actual truth and reconciliation do in fact go hand in hand, necessarily go hand in hand, or even what we might mean by reconciliation in these circumstances. And also different truth commission, truth-seeking processes have included or not reconciliation as part of what they seek with the process. Sometimes they've been focused simply on a fuller version of the truth, or on really providing more of a platform for victims' voices, or for addressing questions of, in some cases, particularly state denial of the event. So it's not a given everywhere that reconciliation has been one of the sought-after, the explicitly sought-after outcomes of a truth-seeking process. And probably it will depend, it will be very much context-driven in a lot of ways, or context-constrained, whether that can happen or not. I think the other question, and so I don't really have a clear answer. I think it's been very different in different places. I think one of the things that truth commissions don't do generally is to develop a consensus history. I think that some of the mythology that maybe dates back 10 or 15 years, you don't get consensus history out of a truth commission process in deeply fragmented or polarized places. It doesn't happen that way. But what you can do is put more versions or a broader version on the table for discussion. And hopefully, in the best of circumstances as well, truth commissions can open doors to further investigation, to further debate, to further exploration. So you're thinking of opening up, broadening, more diverse opinions, and more diverse experiences in the public sphere, as I said before. And I think you can think about that over a long term, maybe not as the immediate outcome of a truth commission, but over a longer-term societal process of leading to more engagement over what history is about and what people's lives have been about and what's the nature of how power is exercised in that place and what it's meant to different people's lives. So I think, again, maybe to constrain a little bit more the issues on the table, or rather what we expect of a truth commission, is really important. You raise another really important point, I think, as well, in terms of how do you actually get people involved. And again, that's different in different places. Lots of times, one of the driving forces have been civil society organizations, which mobilize their bases, and can get the word out into communities, although you're absolutely right, they can be also an enclave within places. But oftentimes, you can get a snowball effect, where an initial group, and then people say, oh, this is interesting. Maybe we should go forward. And it's always going to be a fraction of people, a tiny fraction, really, of people whose lives have been affected, but certainly a more diverse group of people than who've had voices before. But it is a real issue, probably without some part of organized society behind it. It's very hard to imagine how you would get people out.
I think that we've actually run out of time, but I think that was a good way to wrap up. And I want to thank Jean and Marcy and Hani for this incredibly stimulating conversation. And I hope one that will remember. Maybe we can remember, hopefully not too long from now, as one that really planted seeds for a process that I hope will take place. I hope that there will be some sense of some process for reconciliation in Kyrgyzstan. The country desperately needs it, and I hope that someday we'll think back and say, well, you know, I was there when we heard these ideas for a process first being brought forward. So, thank you so much.